Our region has many dichotomies. We're a resort community with multi-million dollar beachfront properties, but we also have issues of poverty, a lack of affordable housing, and a fragile environment. This morning, we talk about philanthropy on the Cape and Islands, some of the challenges for our regional nonprofits, and new strategies to better leverage charitable giving to meet the needs of our community. And joining us here in our Woods Hole studio is Rose Resnick. She's president of Resnick & Associates. Her firm provides nonprofit management and fundraising consulting services. Hello, Rose.
Hello, Sean.
And Kristen O'Malley is here. She's the executive director of the Cape Cod Foundation. Hello, Kristen.
Good morning.
And Sarah Tribuzio is here. She's the managing director of development for us here at WCAI. She also has experience as a fundraiser both on and off Cape Cod. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning, Sean.
Well, thanks for joining us, all of you. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation today, maybe you have a question about philanthropic giving, nonprofits, or even about some of the needs we have here in the region, you can give us a call with your questions, 866-999-4626, 866-999-4626. You can email the point at capeandislands.org. I know our guests are very enthused about taking your phone calls this morning. Well, last time we talked about charitable giving here on The Point, we were just coming out of the recession. So now it's 2014. When you look at philanthropy nationally, what is the level of giving now?
Well, our industry counts on the publication called Giving USA, which hasn't been published yet for 2013. However, there have been reports done by Blackboard and the article, there's been an article in Chronicle of Philanthropy, so that philanthropy did grow in 2013 by 4.9% and raised over $350 billion. Now, most of that money, 72%, does come from individuals, followed by bequests, then foundations. Smaller nonprofits didn't do as well, but they did grow by 3.6%. But an interesting point, people that earn between $50,000 and $75,000 a year give away 7.6% of their discretionary income, as compared to people that make over $100,000 a year. They only give away 4.2% of their discretionary income. International affairs has raised the most money last year, and that's due mainly to disaster situations. But religion and education always top the list of who gets the most money, followed by health care. But interestingly enough, the environment and animal welfare did see increases in donations last year. 62% of the donations increased across nonprofits in the United States. That's the most since 2007. So you can see where, since the economy is starting to get better, that people are giving more to philanthropy. And 3/4 of the people did better than previous years because they really kept their donors informed about how their money was being used. They diversified their revenue streams, meaning they just weren't raising money from foundations. They did annual fund, major gifts, social media. The third of the charities raised most of their money at the last 3 months of the year, the highest obviously during the holiday season in December. And the average gift during that period is $142, and other months of the year, the average gift is $91. Interesting point, female baby boomers and female senior citizens give 89% more than their counterparts. So pay attention to women who are baby boomers and older women. In 2014, nonprofits are really feeling that they're going to have an increase in donors. Their worries are they going to be able to attract new donors? Will the economy continue to trend in the right direction? And are they going to retain their donors? So my advice to our region is to think about diversifying your revenue stream. Don't count on 60% of your donations coming from foundations. And also, pay attention to your donors. Know who's in your donor base. Pay attention to them, take care of them, and steward them.
Now, the Cape and Islands is viewed as a summer playground for the wealthy, but you know that's not, of course, the complete picture, as many of us who live here year-round realize. It's the challenge to get that. Talk about this. Is it difficult to get that message across to potential donors without tarnishing the image of this place as a tourist destination.
It is a delicate balance for sure. And I think when we look, regionally and nationally, there is definitely a perception, that we don't have needs on Cape Cod. And we all know that that's not true. So it's making sure that as a region, we're working to, mine the data and tell the stories in the best possible ways that we can to get the information out there and share the information. It's a reality. It's a reality for a lot of people on Cape Cod. And, we need to make sure that folks understand that. On the flip side, I also do think it's an opportunity if you travel to other parts of the country. Pretty much everyone I've spoken to knows Cape Cod in some way or another. So people are connected. So it's taking those opportunities to, inform those people about some of the challenges and some of the great things that we have happening here, and engaging them in different ways in the community.
Well, let's stick on that. Let's stick with the seasonal population and how that factors into philanthropy. How much time should nonprofits spend focused on seasonal folks versus year-round people?
I think that there's a perception versus a reality, and fundraisers on the Cape and Islands have been talking about this for years. 2.5 years ago, Wendell Marketing in Yarmouthport did a study for Philanthropy Partners of Cape Cod, and the results were very interesting. 75% of donors are residents full-time on Cape Cod. 20% are seasonal, and 5% are off-Cape people. 25% of the people who give those donations are arts and culture organizations, and it kind of makes sense because they're coming here and people like to be entertained. Uh-huh. Membership-driven organizations, however, 40% of their memberships come from seasonal and non-residents. And that is due to and that really shows that you have smaller donations because they're just buying a membership and saying, this is my donation. So a lot of our nonprofits are now struggling, and clients that I have, what's the difference between membership and donations? Because you want people to have memberships, but you also want them to give money. We have competition in a very short season, and people who are seasonal tend to give their larger gifts where their year-round residents are because they feel more of an affiliation with that. So my advice when we're in a seasonal location is we're not the only place in the country that has seasonal residents. So I would benchmark like organizations and see what things they're doing to try to attract these seasonal people, a lot that do have capacity to give money. Understand who's in your database. Have you ever screened your database for capacity to see who are those donors you really want to get to meet? Who's reviewing your list to say, oh, I know so-and-so, or she plays golf with me, to try to make an introduction? But also remember, these seasonal people have to have a passion and be a match for your mission, not just because they have extra means possibly to give away, but that they have to be connected. Again, people give money to institutions and organizations that they feel the passion for, not because they're here on Cape Cod for 4 months of the year. So you really need to find the connections. But my best piece of advice is we all spend a lot of time on these folks who are here for 4 months, and they are very generous. But really think about the rest of your year, how you're spending money with those people, and just don't rely on this constituency, because they know when they come down here that everyone's looking, for their money and their donations.
Sure. We're talking about philanthropic giving and nonprofits, and if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 866-999-4626, 866-999-4626, or you can email us at thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have a new web address there. Kristen O'Malley is here. She's the executive director of the Cape Cod Foundation, along with Rose Resnick, who is here from the Resnick. She's president of Resnick and Associates, and Sarah Tabuzio is here. She's managing director of development here at WCAI. Kristen, tell us a little bit more about the work of the Cape Cod Foundation. I've been fortunate to do some stories related to the foundation, and it's very innovative. I had no idea that these types of groups even existed to help people make some decisions about what they want to do with their money.
Innovative is a good word. I think, you know, we're what's known as a community foundation. So it's actually a designation by the IRS. There are more than 700 community foundations around the country and over 1,000 around the world. And so our model is very different. By design, we're the only one in the area because we're set up to serve a particular geographic area. So we're like a charitable community trust. So we work with donors, individuals, families, businesses, community groups in a lot of different ways. Most to establish a fund. We have over 250 individual funds, and in most cases, those are set up as an endowed fund. The assets are invested, and then we make distributions from those investments back into the community in the form of grants and scholarships. So this year's our 25th anniversary, and we've also just celebrated over $50 million distributed back into the community in the form of grants and scholarships. So we're pretty proud of that.
So if I'm a person of means and I want to, you know, help the world, I want to do philanthropic things, but I mean, that's a lot of work to decide where you want to put your money, how you're going to distribute it, all that. I could go to your organization or an organization like yours and say, here, take this and help me make some decisions. How does it work? Kind of nuts and bolts.
Exactly. So we have six different types of funds that donors can establish with us. And they basically range from a donor advised fund, which is sort of like a mini private foundation. So we provide all of the services that a donor would have if they had their own private foundation. But we provide all the administrative support. There are less fees associated with that. So we provide a lot of that guidance to donors. And then the other funds, we have scholarship funds, and the other four types of funds range in variability for how involved a donor wants to be in that process. So sometimes a donor may establish an unrestricted fund and say, I trust the, you know, grant-making committees of the Cape Cod Foundation to use these assets to meet the community needs that they feel exist at that time. And then the other types of funds kind of, you know, offer different ranges of support and variability for donors.
I see. How does our geography kind of play into giving? Are the Cape and Islands residents more likely to identify with a particular community or town than the region as a whole? For example, I guess I'm thinking about the Cape Cod Foundation has funds specifically for Falmouth and for Chatham.
Yes, I think for us, you know, it's the answer is both. You know, I think it really depends on the donor. And it goes back to what Rose had said in the beginning about, you know, getting to know your donors and understanding what their passions are. And we have two different what we call geographic field of interest funds. So we have the Falmouth Fund and the Chatham Fund now. And they have both been very effective at building resources to support, you know, those two particular towns. We also have donors who give to both of those funds who also support the Cape Cod Foundation because we are a regional organization and our grants are going across the Cape. So it's just a different mechanism to accomplish the same type of goal. So donors, you know, have different interests and different needs, and it kind of gives them an option to do things in different ways.
And again, everyone needs to keep in mind that there are 700 to 900 registered nonprofits on Cape Cod, and philanthropy is a personal decision, and donors are motivated by your mission, your passion, the impact of their gift, and the difference it's going to make. An interesting data point is that on Cape Cod, our nonprofits raise 2.5 times the national average based on population.
Wow.
Which people don't realize, because Massachusetts is the 47th ranked state in generosity in the United States.
But
we do much better here in our region. And I think that I have clients in many different parts of Cape Cod. And for example, I'm working on one such in a small town. And of course, people are going to want to give to this charity because it's right around their home. They're affected by it. They use that. If I had gone to a foundation that was in Hyannis to try to raise money for this other nonprofit, they have no affiliation. They have no interest. Just because people have money, they have to have the interest. And also, I think with seasonal residents, they want to make sure that the area they're living in, as well as the year-rounders, are raising the money for things that are in their community. So I have to agree with Kristen that people are very town and community focused, whether they're here year round or summering here or just coming for a visit.
We're talking about philanthropic giving and nonprofits. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk about major donors. We're talking about philanthropic giving and nonprofits here on The Point on WCAI. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Give us your questions or your comments. 866-999-4626. 866-999-4626. Or you can email The Point at capeandislands.org. We have a lot of information here in the room, a lot of good advice if you have a question, so let us know. Sarah Trabuzio is here. She's Managing Director of Development for us here at WCAI. Sarah, let me ask you about major donors. You know, nonprofits love to cultivate and engage major donors, people who can make significant donations, but the truth is there are more people who can make the smaller donations. So if you're a nonprofit, how do you determine how to spend your resources or your time?
That's a really good question, Sean. And I want to preface this conversation by saying that every gift matters, whether it's $50 or $50,000. And yes, average, or what I'm going to call a mid-level donor, they can and they will make major gifts if they're appropriately stewarded and cultivated. Hmm. I think of mid-level donors as the folks that can bridge the gap between your regular annual fund donors to major giving. And sometimes mid-level donors may or may not lead to major gifts, but it's what you do in the interim and how you move them through your pipeline that is going to determine that. Major donors are different for everybody in terms of dollar level giving. So, for example, some organizations may view a major donor as somebody who gives $500 or $1,000. Other organizations, such as CAI, view major donors as someone that gives a gift of $5,000 or above. So it really can be different for whatever organization that you're a part of. So your sustainable donors are the donors that develop through your annual fund or your membership program. We talked a little bit about that earlier. Annual fund are donors that give an annual gift year after year after year, and they're cultivated over time. And research supports that donors that make $1,000 gifts to organizations most often when they already have been giving to an organization for 7 years. Hmm. And longer-term research states that those very same donors are 900% more likely to make a major gift in their lifetime. 900%. That's crazy. But I think what's most important is that it takes 7 years. It takes time. It takes time. Mm. It's not going to happen overnight. So with that in mind, it's really important to get back into your database. And I know Rose had mentioned this earlier. You need to know who your donors are. You need to spend time getting to know them. And for those folks that spend a lot of that think about, why am I losing my lapsed donors? Why do I only get a donor for a year or two? It's because you're not spending the time getting to know them. It's a lack of stewardship. And so there's a lot of different ways we can reach our donors. There's many different channels. There's direct mail. There's events. There's online giving. There's so many different channels. And I think it's really important for organizations to look at their donors, to make a plan, and to start everything at, you know, how do we want to reach these donors and what's the plan?
Rose Resnick is here as well. She's president of Resnick and Associates. And Kristen O'Malley is here. She's the executive director of the Cape Cod Foundation. Let's talk a little bit more about major donors. So do most major donors start off in that mid-level and then move up, or is it more often that they come in as a major donor?
Many different ways of coming in. I think the important thing for organizations, and I've heard this three different times, every organization in their toolkit, the first thing they should do is have a case for support. It doesn't have to be a big, expensive, glossy brochure. But people, even when they're going to foundations, and I'm sure, Kristen, you've seen applications, what is your plan? Why do you need the money? What is the impact of your gift? Are you just asking me for money because you need money to fill a gap? You need to explain to them what a difference their donation is going to make. Very, very important for organizations to have their case when they go to speak to donors, when they go to speak to foundations, when they're writing proposals. 50% of your revenue should come from individuals. So if you think of the pie, cut it in half, and you should be concentrating on that 50%. Then you cut that 50%, as Sarah said, and have a strategy for your annual, your mid-level, and then your major donors. So when you ask the question, you should be spending 90% on your top 10%, because remember, I've suggested that you screen that those donors and you know who your donors are. But what happens on Cape Cod, major donors, whatever you define it, you might get one ultimate gift from that person in their lifetime. That's it. And it takes a long time to do it. As my friend Karen Bissonnette, one of the best fundraisers on Cape Cod, says, it's a sprint, not a marathon. But however, our Cape Cod organizations, because some of them are so small, need immediate cash. They don't have the patience to go through that process of all the time it takes to schmooze these donors when you want to get a $5,000 or a $10,000 ask. A lot of people don't like to ask for money. And executive directors are wearing five hats. So in a smaller nonprofit, who's the one asking for the money? I suggest that you pay attention to the top percent for your major gift strategy. You do 5 to 7 touch points with them. You send them an email. You invite them to something. You invite them to lunch where you don't ask them for money. You just want to hear their opinions about what they think about your organization. Opinions are free. And remember that you should have an 85% retention rate on all of your donors. Because once you lose a donor, it's hard to get them back. So call them, get to know them, thank them, don't give up, but follow up and follow through on anybody that you go to visit on that 10%.
Are you finding that donors, major donors, are more interested now than before in learning exactly the impact their gifts are having?
Absolutely.
They're looking for more numbers. And what are they looking for, and how do you provide that?
Well, everyone needs operating budget, and there's a way to position that. And those gifts come from people who have been affiliated with the organization for a longer time because they understand that. But they want to know, what am I giving to? Well, how's it going to make a difference? Whose impact, how many lives is it impact? And am I going to feed 500 children? Am I going to equip a shelter for a year? Am I going to help people that are in addiction trying to get recovery? How many? If I'm going to give you $10,000, how are you going to use it? And how are you going to steward it? And then I want to know how you spent my money,
right,
in a report or a tour of the organization. And if people can do that, they know their plan, they cultivate and take steward their money and get back to them to say, here's what we did, they will definitely have a higher percentage of getting another major gift.
And I just can't stress how important it is to say thank you.
Oh, sure.
I can't tell you how many times donors have literally been surprised when I've called them to say thank you.
So a letter isn't enough?
You need to do both.
Really?
You really do. And if you're in a small shop and you're the only person that's doing this, then you need to engage your board members or volunteers to help with some of these calls. But yes, a timely acknowledgement within 24 hours is standard. And certainly a phone call goes a long way.
And I've said to my clients, this is a good way to use your board and your volunteers, even if they leave a message and the machine.
We all get multiple solicitations for donations from various organizations. What do you recommend nonprofits do as a way to kind of distinguish themselves, set themselves apart from this crowded field? Anyone? Go ahead, Kristen.
Well, I was going to add, it kind of goes to the other question, too, about what donors are looking for. We've seen our donors, again, wanting to be more engaged in knowing what the impacts and the outcomes are of the dollars that they're contributing. But I think also from an organizational perspective, our donors are really becoming increasingly interested in how the organization is run. What are the efficiencies in the organization? And, you know, I think we all know about the challenges with sort of the percentages that are thrown around and how they're used as far as operating and, you know, know, fundraising expenses and things like that. But I think it's very important for organizations to understand how to explain to donors how the organization runs. Why do they have these programs? How do they offset this program? How do they diversify revenue? I think our donors are becoming increasingly more interested in that aspect of organizations. We all know that there are a lot of nonprofits on the Cape. So, you know, why should a donor donate to this particular organization versus this that might be doing the same thing? How are they run differently or the same, or, you know, what programs are they doing differently or the same?
When it comes to that, such as overhead, which donors are definitely concerned about, are you more likely to find a charitable organization locally that has less overhead, that more of the money is going to be going to what their activity is versus maybe a larger national organization? Maybe those numbers aren't out there.
Well, I think I don't want to necessarily say it's a disadvantage, but because in our region we have so many smaller nonprofits, mm-hmm. that they're, you know, they really need their boards and volunteers to help them with fundraisings, which would help keep their costs down.
Right.
And I think operating is a big issue. But again, in this time in philanthropy, you need to have funding priorities underneath just your operating, because I think that really reinforces your operating budget. I mean, everyone understands you have to pay the staff, but then what is, and that's what your operating is, but then what are the other programs you're doing that your staff is working on makes a stronger case for support.
Learning how to brand yourself and market yourself are two lessons nonprofits are taking from the business community, as is strategic planning. Can you explain what strategic planning is and why nonprofits should probably be doing it? Rose?
Well, organizations, again, going back to what Kristen said, want to know if you have a strategic plan, and if it's a viable strategic plan, what's your vision and where are you going? And it's not a document that you put in the drawer and say, oh, we did it. Mm. It should be your working document. And as I always say to my clients, you need a strategic plan, and then each of those need an operating, and you need a development plan. It never ceases to amaze me how many organizations that I go in have a strategic plan. It's either outdated or they want a new one. But where's their development plan? Where's their operational plan? Even if it's just two or three pages, what's your goal for your annual fund? How many donors are you increasing? People need to look at their data and start benchmarking their own data. And that goes back up to the strategic plan. The strategic plan gives the vision of the organization, but then it becomes operational. And then it's up to the fundraisers to determine how they're going to raise money for this strategic plan. Very, very important.
Yes.
To have one.
I sort of see the strategic plan as an organizational SWOT analysis, you know, so I think it's, again, back to that sort of increasing organizational efficiency and effectiveness. It's an opportunity for an organization to look at what they're doing really well, maybe where there are some challenges, you know, as far as just from a program standpoint. Are there programs that are losing money and are a big drain on the organization, and they could either be doing them differently or working more collaboratively with another organization to, you know, have similar effects or really maybe even amplify their effects.
We're talking about philanthropy and nonprofits and giving, and we invite you to be part of the conversation. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Rose Resnick is here. She's president of Resnick and Associates, which a firm that provides nonprofit management and fundraising consulting. Kristen O'Malley is here. She's the executive director of the Cape Cod Foundation. And Sarah Tabuzio is joining us as well. She's managing director of development for us here at WCAI. You've talked about boards has come up several times during this conversation about nonprofit boards. As we talk about marketing and branding and strategic planning, I'm thinking it might make sense to have some of those folks from the business community on your board. What is the role of boards in a nonprofit, and what kinds of people do nonprofits look for to serve on their boards?
Well, I'm going to start this being the consultant who doesn't have to report to a board. So
good thinking.
We decided I'd go first on this. Successful organizations have successful boards, and each organization should think about what does that mean to them. Successful boards are those that look at the big picture in the future rather than the operational. They should be thinking about what's the mission, what's the vision, what do they need for governance, their fiduciary responsibilities, ethics, Who's on their nominating committee? What's the process to put a new board member on? The integrity of the organization, compliance, legalities, all of those things. And if they're busy doing all that, they don't have time to discuss daily operations such as staffing, event catering. I mean, there's all different types of boards in our region. That's why they've hired the executive director, and they really need to back their executive director. Philanthropy over the last 5 years with boards has really changed the composition of a board, meaning that a lot, and from my experience, we need to change the culture that governance is also including philanthropy. If you have fiduciary responsibilities on a board, then part of that is helping them raise money, that it's not just up to the executive director. The board has to get involved. And there's many ways the board can get involved without having to ask money. As Sarah had mentioned, call your donors. Call your donors you're losing. Ask them why. Is there anything we can learn from that? There's many people in our region that sit on two or four boards. My question is, which is their priority and which is their philanthropic number, and which of those are their number one philanthropic interest? So boards play an important, important role on Cape Cod. They do need to change their culture. And there's so many people out there that would love to be on boards without going to the same people who populate two or four boards, who are very great people. But we also need to start diversifying with the millennials and Gen Yers to get some younger people on the board, but not as token board members, as one young, he's 40, said, I don't want to be the only 40-year-old on a board. Mm-hmm. So I think boards in this time with philanthropy really need to take a step back and look at their whole strategic plan and the role of the board and expectations of board members.
And I would also add, I mean, your board members can and should be your best ambassadors. You know, so for us, we're a small organization, and so we rely on our board members to be out there talking about the Cape Cod Foundation and what we're doing. And so for me as executive director, it's important that I provide them with the tools to make sure that they are comfortable doing that.
Dana is calling in from South Wellfleet. Good morning, Dana.
Thank you. Hi.
Hello.
You know, I'm glad they're doing all this. This is very important. However, I'm a little concerned about market rhetoric and language infiltrating nonprofits. I think the markets and Wall Street have too big a grip on our social infrastructure as it is. And also on a personal level, I am a citizen, not a consumer. I'm not interested. I don't want to be reduced to a brand or a product.
Okay. Are we seeing that as a trend? Does that ring true with anyone at the table? That
no,
we're Wall Street influence? No. Okay. Well, I guess we're not seeing that as a trend. Thank you for the question, Dana. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk about philanthropy and nonprofits. We're going to continue to take your questions and your comments. We're talking about philanthropic giving and nonprofits and some of the needs that we have in this region. You can be part of this conversation. Give us a call, 866-999-4626, 866-999-4626, or you can email thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let you know who's here talking today. Rose Resnick, president of Resnick & Associates. Her firm provides lots of nonprofits, some advice and consulting services on management and fundraising. Kristen O'Malley is here. She's the executive director of the Cape Cod Foundation, and Sarah Tribuzio, Managing Director of Development for us here at WCAI. She has a lot of experience as a fundraiser, both on and off Cape Cod. Let's talk about events. Many nonprofits hold events to hold fundraisers or raise awareness. What are some of the pros and cons of holding events? How do you know maybe even when an event is time to go away?
I have a big smile on my face right now as I look around the table because, you know, events are so important on so many levels. And, you know, and to be honest, they're fun. They attract new supporters to our organizations. They raise the visibility. They involve a larger number of people. They encourage board and volunteer involvement, which is really important. They pull diverse groups of people together, and they help build your mailing list. So let's face it, you know, they're really important on a lot of different levels. And I think the most important thing with an event is that you are uniting people together in a place to celebrate the mission of this organization. And it's a real sense of commitment. So I really want to say that events really are important. The challenge with events, and I'm not going to say it's like a con necessarily. I'm going to say that it's a challenge.
Okay.
events take a lot of time. And
sure.
We've talked about nonprofits on the Cape as being small staffed. And so when you take the time to plan an event, it takes time away from the other things that that you need to be doing, like raising money through other avenues. So it takes a lot of planning, a lot of organization. But if you have a working board, a roll up your sleeves working board, and great event committees, they can help you with that. So it's really important to have those pieces in place if you're going to be executing on an annual event, let's say, every year. The other thing that can happen in an event, especially if you do it in the summertime, which many of our events here on Cape Cod do happen in the summertime, is that you can compete with other events that are happening. And weather can play a big factor, especially if it's an outside event. So I really believe that, you know, people, smaller staffs and development shops, they think about events as being, oh my gosh, how am I going to get all of this done? Plus everything else that I have to do, you know, to keep the shop running. But I think events are really important. And I think if you are engaging your board and volunteers in a meaningful way, they can be really, really helpful for your organization.
How do you decide when to have that event? You mentioned most of the events are here in the summer, and I think you're right about that. But we heard earlier that about 75%, I think it was, of givers are year-round residents. And we know it can be pretty isolating in the winter. Is there value in making a decision to have something in the colder months when maybe you don't have the bigger population here?
Well, I can say right now, because we just came out of our WCAI winter film series, I do think it's important to engage your audience during sort of the, what I'm going to call the doldrums, you know, the January, February, March, where everybody's just waiting for the warm weather to happen. I think it really depends on your organization. For us, I think it was a great opportunity to engage our donors in something that was a little bit different than what we had done in the past. But I really believe that it just matters on your organization's priorities and what it is that you're trying to accomplish.
Bob Motorstock is calling in from Brewster. He is with Cape Mediation, which is a nonprofit. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for calling in. What's your question or comment today?
Well, first I want to thank the Cape Cod Foundation for giving us a gift in the past. We really appreciate that. It's helped us a lot.
Welcome.
So I'm wondering, is there any particular resource that lists the organizations or the sources of gifts or grants available for nonprofits on Cape Cod? We're just concerned that we're missing some of the organizations or grant writers that can give us gifts, and we haven't sent them out requests or proposals.
Okay, that might be a good question for Rose Resnick.
Well, I think that there's a website called Foundation Center where you can sign up for that. I think it's $59.95 and get a good researcher to go through it quickly. The other good thing about that is they also have family foundations on that website. Look at GuideStar, another good resource that won't cost you any money. And Google. What foundations that give to blank in Massachusetts. You can do a lot of things for a very few money to get your research. AGM is another organization that could help you research, especially in Massachusetts. So there's some, if you can find a good researcher on your board, you can do it for a very little money.
I might also add, Bob, that you can also look at other organizations' annual reports. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, they'll list the grant makers that they've received funding from. So I would look at other organizations that are doing similar things as to your organization, look at their annual reports, and that could also give you a jumping start to do further research.
And even taking it off Cape, Bob, as well, and looking at organizations in other parts of the country that maybe are receiving funding from other regional or national funders that may be interested in supporting what you're doing here on Cape Cod.
And that would be through foundationcenter.com?
I think it's Foundation Center. Yeah, that's all. You just Google it, and you'll get the link.
And GuideStar was another.
Yes, GuideStar is another.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate the call. Barbara is calling in from Brewster. Hello, Barbara.
Yes, I'm wondering if people could comment on generally what percentage of a gift that you send, for example, annually, is spent on the administration.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that a little earlier, but maybe we can are there hard numbers, or maybe it depends on the organization?
Again, the best source for that is GuideStar, which is a website which rates nonprofits and explains that, but also looking at people's annual reports. Yeah. But keeping in mind that the operating budgets are so important, or they wouldn't have the rest of the programming that they offer if they don't have the staff. But that's a good resource. Again, GuideStar, and ask your favorite nonprofits for their annual reports, Barbara.
I wonder if there's any effort made to encourage the organizations to give this information in their thank you letters.
Well, what do you think about that?
It's a good thought.
I imagine if you're pretty proud of
it. I gave a number of gifts, year-end gifts, this past year, and I got one letter back thanking me, telling me that 90% of the gift was spent on the actual,
charity itself, the work.
Charity, yes.
Barbara, how did you feel about that percentage?
Well, I would like to hear that from all of them.
So 90% sounds fair to you.
I understand how much of my gift is actually going to the point.
Barbara, 90% is a really good number, and I would suggest that you are the donor and call the other nonprofits and ask that question if they don't have it in their annual report.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Barbara. Great questions. Thanks. Another avenue for nonprofit funding is grants. And Kristen, what advice do you have for area nonprofits looking for grant funding?
Well, again, as we've discussed, you know, there are a lot of nonprofits competing for limited resources on the Cape. So I think it's just, as Rose was talking about different avenues, and Sarah mentioned a number as well, to really do your research and to explore different opportunities for grant funding. And I think really the key when you're applying for grants is to make sure that there's a fit between the funder and what you're looking to do. You never want to, as an organization, create something just for a funder. We would never want an organization to do that. So I think it's really important to understand what the parameters are and you know, what the fit is between the funder and the organization.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I was just going to add on to what Kristen's comments is, after you develop your list of the foundations that you're going to go to, it's really important, A, to read the proposal and read the directions, and B, I have a rule that if at all possible, always make a phone call to that foundation or that program officer before you take the time to write that proposal. Have that conversation. It's kind of similar to what we've been talking about this morning. Always having conversations, reaching out, talking about your organization, making sure that your proposal is a good fit, really establishes that relationship and increases your chances of hopefully getting funding. I'd also give another second piece of advice that perhaps you might get a no. You have this great conversation. Mm-hmm. You spend the time filling out the proposal, but the letter comes back and it's, I'm sorry, but there were other organizations that were worthy, you know, standard letter. My advice would be to call up that program officer or that foundation and ask them why. They really should be able to tell you why your proposal maybe didn't make the cut. And that's really important feedback for you for the next time that you're going to submit. And my big thing is get in line and stay in line until you're told to get out.
I had a great conversation with a well-respected funder this year talking about this subject. And he told me that I would be flabbergasted to see how some of these grant proposals come in. Their presentation isn't even good. They're taped. They can't, when they come to ask, they can't really, some people, not all, can't answer the question, what's your plan? What's the impact of the gift? What's the end result? Tell me more. I'm just not going to be, because I have the means, a stopgap, you know, to help you get through the year. Why do you need my money and how are you going to use it? And also to treat that foundation as a loyal donor and make sure that you're keeping, if they give you the money, keeping in touch with them and letting them know how their money's being spent and inviting them to this site. Again, engage, engage, engage.
I think the conventional wisdom is that time is just as important a resource as money. I don't know if that's true. Perhaps that's just the first part of the question. But what is the second part would be, what is the best way to utilize a volunteer's time?
I think, you know, it really depends on what the organization's needs are and what they have the capacity to handle and what the interests are of the volunteer. There's a great organization, Cape Cod Volunteers, that has a website, and they will match organizations that have needs within the organization with potential volunteers. They also have two drop-in centers around the Cape as well. And I think, you know, for an organization, it's really important to understand what your capacity is to take on volunteers. I think it's kind of a challenge because the smaller organizations are the ones that a lot of times need the volunteers, but they don't necessarily have the capacity to manage them. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for organizations to understand what they can take on and provide meaningful opportunities. I think we're seeing more and more that organizations are, you know, offering meaningful opportunities for folks to volunteer.
John Cox is joining us on the phone. He's president of Cape Cod Community College. I understand he's on his cell phone, but he pulled over safely to the side of the road. Good morning, John.
Hi, Sean. Yes, actually, I'm off the road, and I'm picking you up in places I haven't picked you up in before since you have that power boost.
Yes, 90.1.
Yeah, I'm up in the Plymouth area today, so a very timely conversation for us about philanthropy as higher education has continued to evolve and funding sources have changed over time. There's now much more of a reliance of a need to turn to the community to try to increase giving, to offset tuition for our students, and to invest in our facilities. So it's increasingly a bigger challenge for many institutions in higher ed.
That would make sense. Anyone at the table working with higher ed or any other?
I've worked with higher ed in the past. And one of the groups when I was working at NMIT, it was always, oh, it'll be so difficult to raise money from the parents because they're already paying tuition. But I think that parents are so committed to their child's education, and there were a lot of students there that whose parents were not wealthy people. But even if you look out to the parents and ask for $25, it's about potential of trying to get different segments of donors. Your alumni, Cape Cod Community College has alumni who have gone on to do good things. Mm-hmm. You could start with making sure your database has everybody in there and start to ask them for time, you know, time and some contributions. $25 with a lot of people are 50 or 100 because they felt they got something out of it, want to give back to it. And that's how you'd start building your alumni fund database, which I think would be really a good thing for the college to do. And as people become more successful on Cape Cod, that can become your constituency of donors, your alumni.
Absolutely. It's all about participation. And it's pretty powerful when you can say, you know, 100% of X participated in the annual fund. I think that is more compelling than necessarily somebody that gives a larger gift.
Is John still there? John, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I would agree wholeheartedly, and that 100% level is what we strive for, no doubt.
Of course. John, thanks for the phone call. Real quick, we've got about 30 seconds left. What about social media on Cape Cod and using that to help fundraise? Is it a lot of benefit or maybe not as much as in a larger, higher population or
Well, so we use social media here at WCAI to mostly spread the word about what we're doing and to talk about what's happening in our region. But I do think that there is a time and a place for raising money through social media, but I really think it depends on the organization and what their mission and goals are.
Okay. Great conversation about philanthropic giving and about nonprofits. And I want to thank my guest, Rose Resnick, president of Resnick & Associates, Kristen O'Malley, the executive director of the Cape Cod Foundation, and Sarah Tabuzio, managing director of development for us here at WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.